sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rabbi Dr. Arthur Green, renowned scholar of Jewish mysticism and spirituality. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Last week, I attended a very interesting meeting here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live. I had the privilege of being asked by Congressman Ron Barber to sit on a task force on mental health, assembled in the hope of providing input to Congress on how we are going to address the kinds of problems in our society that have contributed to the awful mass murder attacks of the last couple of months, frankly, of the last couple of years. You know, the ones on elementary and high school and shopping malls and religious services and public events of all kinds. While other task forces are focusing on moving towards a universal gun background check, pretty darn good idea if you ask me, so that violent felons and the dangerously mentally ill can't buy weapons easily, and on restricting access to large capacity magazines that have been used for these horrible attacks, our task force's purview was to learn about and make recommendations on improving the care and treatment of the mentally ill. There are a few common elements in each of the horrific, well-publicized shootings that we've seen in the last few years. They were delineated at the meeting. You know, the shootings in Tucson 2 years ago, at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut in December, at the Sikh Temple last summer, in the movie theater in Aurora, Colorado in July, and so on. Really, in almost all the mass killings in the U.S. of late. The first element is that each was carried out by a young man. The second, that the perpetrator was mentally ill, usually diagnosed as such. Third, the perpetrator was not currently in treatment or on medication for that mental illness, that it was an untreated mental illness. Fourth, the shooter was estranged from society. Fifth, he became agitated for some reason. Sixth, he had access to a semi-automatic gun or guns that could fire from 30 to 50 rounds without reloading. And sixth, this is a weird one, the shooter was white. Congressman Barber re-proposed a new federal program last week called Mental Health First Aid, which prepares first responders, teachers, parents, clergy, and others to identify and respond to signs of mental illness and psychiatric crisis. This is a start at addressing our long decline in support for mental health funding and facilities, which those of us in the clergy know all about because, well, the results are those people come to us. Now, I say this was re-proposed, this mental health first aid bill, because Congress couldn't get its act together to pass it last year. But now, after Newtown, maybe we can all make this happen. Frankly, we need to do something soon, or the children who died in that first grade classroom will have died really in vain, and those empty beds will just lead to more empty beds in the future. This addresses the first piece of the mental health problem in our society, and we'll see how Vice President Biden's recommendations go on our national legislature and federal government. Our hope is that controls can be implemented that'll improve everyone's safety and security. We know one thing. We must act, and now. Pikuach nefesh, the saving of human life, is the highest Jewish value, greater than any other. It's now in our court to take steps to protect innocent life and to help our representatives make the courageous decisions to change things in important ways. In spite of the obvious vocal opposition of such charlatans as James Baker and the other officials of the NRA. You know, I honestly believe that most gun owners see the pronouncements coming out of the NRA about the terrible danger of an impending assault on the Second Amendment for what they are, preposterous stonewalling attempts to deny that the arrogant, hostile approach of the NRA has contributed to the deaths of innocents by preventing very basic, intelligent, important standards for responsible gun owners. You know, the Second Amendment protects the right to bear arms in a properly constituted militia, and it is very important. So, too, is the opening of the Declaration of Independence, the first great formative document of our country. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life is the first inalienable right. No one has a right to take that life away by shooting up a public space. And no person or organization can possibly claim the right to guarantee to that shooter, mentally ill or of past violent criminal record, the ability to easily procure a semi-automatic weapon and high-capacity magazines, that supersedes the right all of us have to remain alive. January is flying by, and today we'll be re-inaugurating President Barack Obama for a second term as Chief Executive of the United States. From a Jewish perspective, most of the attention is focused on the big three spots in the cabinet, the incoming positions of Secretary of State, now taken by former Senator John Kerry, Secretary of Defense, now to be filled with some controversy by former Senator Chuck Hagel. It's not too clear how much he loves Israel, by the way. And Jack Lew, the new Treasury Secretary. Lew is the first Orthodox Jew to hold that position, and if confirmed by the Senate, as is expected, he will be the highest-ranking Orthodox Jew in American history. Lew has been the White House Chief of Staff, where he replaced, among others, another Jewish guy, the current mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel. While there have been many other Jewish cabinet members over the years, including Henry Kissinger as Secretary of State under both Nixon and Ford, Jack Lew is the first Orthodox Jew to get to such a high position. It's an interesting and impressive moment in American history. The only footnote is that then-Senator Joe Lieberman, also an Orthodox Jew, was in line to become vice president under Al Gore in that incredibly close presidential election in the year 2000. And perhaps Lieberman might have actually run for president after that. He famously said, "I promise to work for the United States of America 24/6. That is, you know, all day, every day, except on Shabbos. But back to Lew. In nominating Lew for Secretary of the Treasury, succeeding Timothy Geithner, President Obama said, "As the son of a Polish immigrant, a man of deep and devout faith, Jack knows that every number on a page, every dollar we budget, every decision we make has to be an expression of who we wish to be as a nation, our values." Lew, a chief of the Office of Management and Budget under both Obama and Clinton, has spoken often about balancing his Shabbat observance with the demands of the highest precincts of government. Lew has the most powerful guy in the world to keep track of the time as the sun begins to dip low in the sky on Friday afternoons. He said, "I saw the president on many occasions on Friday look at his watch and say, 'Isn't it time for you to get going?' Or, 'Why are you still here?' The president was not checking the clock because he doesn't think I can keep time," Lew said. "Rather, the extra care reflects the president's wish to remind me that it's important to him, not just to me, that I be able to make that balance." We hope that as Treasury Secretary, Jack Lew can also balance something even harder, the U.S. budget. By the way, Lew is a prominent member of Avi Weiss's Riverdale Synagogue in New York.
So fear.
This is also the week that Israel holds elections for the Knesset. On Tuesday, it'll vote on its new parliament and prime minister. Everybody knows that Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu will be returned to office. There's essentially no real challenger on the scene who can put together anywhere near enough votes to take office. The general consensus is that the Israeli electorate continues to move rightward, mostly because Israelis have lost hope that there ever will be real peace with a Palestinian people that continually embraces complete Islamic rejection of Israel or public puffery designed to impress the media and the rest of the world with the great independence of the Palestinians. Anyway, in this climate, the alliance between the Likud, the right-wing party of Bibi Netanyahu, and the even further right-wing secularists of Avigdor Lieberman, with the right-wing religious parties coming along for the ride and, you know, a little bit of bakshish, continues to make this country move, should be no surprise, rightward. The election is very unlikely to change that, nor is that necessarily a terrible thing. Since it's not clear whom Israel would successfully negotiate with on the Palestinian side right now anyway, and the Israeli economy continues to thrive as Israel moves towards a population of 8 million, might just be okay to go with the status quo. Under the old and very likely new Prime Minister Netanyahu, we can hope nonetheless for progress. For sometimes elected officials in a position of real strength are also in a position to make courageous and positive compromises that move everything forward. And so, we can hope and pray that Bibi Netanyahu can make real progress in this term. So during this very political time, and to play us in on a fine, cool morning, here's a wonderful song called Keren Or, about bringing light into a dark time. From the Yemenite Israeli American star Achinoam Nini, Noah. Was Noah singing Keren Or about light coming in when none seems to be shining. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, the outstanding scholar, teacher, and thinker, Rabbi Dr. Arthur Green, will explain why Jewish mysticism has always been considered too extreme for the average Jew in America, and why that's no longer true. Find out why when he joins us in a few moments on To Jewish.
There's nothing like a live radio show to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the Two Jewish Radio Show, featuring Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends. It's live at the Fox Theater on March 2nd.
Better than Prairie Home Companion, it's Deli Home Companion. Join me and my great guests, including Richard Lewis, for a live radio variety show to benefit Jewish Family and Children's Services, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and Temple Emmanuel. Saturday night, March 2nd at the Fox.
Tickets at the box office and FoxTucsonTheater.org, or learn about sponsorship opportunities by calling 327-4501.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome the two Jewish art guests this morning. Rabbi Arthur Green, recognized as one of the world's preeminent authorities on Jewish thought, mysticism, spirituality, and Hasidism, for that matter. In addition to his rabbinical school role at the Hebrew College as rector, he serves as the Irving Brudnick Professor of Philosophy and Religion at Hebrew College and is Professor Emeritus at Brandeis University. He was the head of the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College, Dean and President from 1984 to 1993. His writings are well known throughout the Jewish world. His most recent book is Radical Judaism, Rethinking God and Tradition through Yale. He's also written A Guide to the Zohar and Seek My Face, Speak My Name, among a number of other books, and a seminal work on Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav. We welcome Rabbi Dr. Arthur Green. Good morning.
Good morning. Wonderful to be with you.
It's a pleasure. What began your deep interest in Jewish mysticism and spirituality?
It's hard to answer that question on a biographical level. I had, by the time I was 20 and discovered the mystical tradition, been through a secular and an orthodox period, neither of them satisfying me, and I was looking for another deeper way to read the Jewish tradition and make the Jewish tradition work for me. But on a kind of spiritual level, my soul was drawn to the material. As soon as I began studying and reading, I knew instinctively that this was the language of my soul.
You know, as someone who himself grew up with a deep Jewish background, we didn't really study anything you could call Kabbalah all the way through my Jewish educational experience. Frankly, I could have been ordained a Reform rabbi and never have opened any text that would be in any way considered mystical. Is that a misfortune?
That is right. What happened was, in the early 19th century, when Jews were seeking a respectable place in the Western world, they had to create a new notion that had never existed before called mainstream Judaism. Mainstream Judaism, the notion of mainstream Judaism, was created in order to exclude anything that embarrassed modern, westernizing, rational Jews, and that was primarily the mystical tradition. So for 200 years, it was mostly swept under the rug in the Jewish community, ignored, not part of the mainstream, doesn't have to be taught or passed on. And only in the last 20 or 30 years are Jews all over the world scrambling to recover this part of the tradition and to make it part of the legacy again. The big question before us is how to do that right. And that's really what my work is about.
We will explore that question and how Hasidism came to a cliff and backed away and many other interesting subjects with the terrific Rabbi Dr. Arthur Green when we come back on Two Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona income taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime by directing your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. Here's how. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations who provide scholarships for kids in kindergarten through 12th grade to go to qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Congregation Anshe Israel Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, Temple Emmanuel's Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy. If you pay Arizona state income tax and make your contribution to JETCO, you'll get 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax return. Join over 750 supporters last year who gave money to JETCO and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income tax. New this year, there's an additional tax credit, the switcher credit. It increases the maximum donation you can make to JETCO to $1,003 for single filers and $2,006 for married couples filing jointly. When we fight every day for the continuity of the Jewish people, take advantage of this great opportunity. JETCO is one way to foster a Jewish identity for our community's kids. Contributions to JETCO have helped hundreds of children receive financial aid in order to get a Jewish education. Call 647-8442. Again, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Give the gift of education. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. In order to see Rabbi Art Green, our terrific guest this morning, in person, everybody is welcome to attend the Rabbi Albert T. Bill Gray Lectureship at the University of Arizona and at Temple Emmanuel on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, February 7th, 8th, and 9th. His overall topic is Kabbalah, Hasidism, and Spirituality. He'll be speaking at the U of A Thursday night at 7, at Temple Emmanuel at 7:30 p.m. Friday night, and at noon on Saturday, that first weekend in February. Call 327-4501 for more information. All events of the Bill Gray Lectureship are free and open to the public. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center here in Tucson. Welcome, Guy. Boker Tov and almost Chag Sameach.
Boker Tov and Chag Tu Bishvat Sameach.
So Tu Bishvat is the new year for trees, what many people would think of as an obscure holiday, but really quite a delightful one.
Well, I think it's one of the best holidays. I still remember the times as a kid where every Tu Bishvat we would go out with the entire school and plant trees. Israel is one of the only, if not the only, Western country that had more trees by the year 2000 than it had at the year 1900. And one of the reasons is because of Tu Bishvat. It was a huge tradition of going out and planting trees in the land of Israel. And, you know, as a kid, it's such a joy. You go, you dig in the soil, you get your hands all dirty, you get your clothes all dirty. Mother is not always happy about that, but then you tell her the story about the small tree and how it will grow and it will have your name, and it's really cute. And we are going to celebrate Tu Bishvat here in Tucson as well.
Right.
We won't be planting trees because that doesn't work for us here, weather and places. And also the tradition is to plant the trees in Israel.
In Israel, of course.
Many people, by the way, along the years were donating money to plant trees in Israel.
The Jewish National Fund, of course.
Exactly.
Karen Kamen Israel.
In the latest year, Tu Bishvat got a new twist, and it became more of an ecological celebration, celebrating the earth, educating the kids about how important it is to keep our earth, our planet, our environment. And that will be part of the focus of our celebration that will take place on January 24th at the JCC from 5 o'clock to 6:30 p.m. we will do the Tu Bishvat Ardi party. We will host in this party a local artist from Tucson that will lead community artworks. People can come and join in and take part in those artworks that combine the concept of trees, environment, and our love to Israel. The event will also have a light dinner provided for anyone who comes, and video clips and stories about what's happening in Israel in Tu Bishvat and around the world in Tu Bishvat. And it's a great party, a great fun party for all the family, for young kids, older kids, even 60-year-old kids, whatever kids you have. And even if you feel that you are a kid, that's
completely... Yeah, I'm a completely. Kid at heart, certainly. So.
And we'll come and celebrate together the environment, the trees, the importance of the trees to us. It's very interesting, you know, in Jewish tradition, trees have a very significant place. Even in the rules of war, it is prohibited
from an army cutting down the trees,
trees.
From the Torah, right.
And it's very interesting. We'll talk all about it in the party. Come join us.
Sounds great. I should also note, in the interest of, you know, even-handedness, that on Friday night the 25th, we'll have a big Tu Bishvat wine tasting and gourmet juice tasting.
Wow.
Dinner and musical service with a lot of ecological themes at Temple Emmanuel.
Sounds great.
Should be fantastic. Please join us for that too. 327-4501. Thanks, Guy. Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
We'll talk next week. When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Last week we began speaking about the ways in which the Shoah, the Holocaust, is used not only in Jewish life in America, around the world, but in Israel. Let's continue some of those discussions.
Well, we just reached the point where we're talking about how the most diverse range of uses, in quotation marks, is in Europe, where different political parties in different societies treat the Holocaust in very different ways and use it, sometimes even exploit it, for very different objectives. The most obvious and extreme is the Holocaust deniers, who are sort of replaying the old tapes about the international Zionist conspiracy and how Jews control the news and control world affairs, and there's a hidden hand, and that the whole story of the Holocaust is a myth created by Jews. And these deniers have an audience, undoubtedly, in almost every country in Europe. The size of the audience varies. In Germany, there's actually a law against Holocaust denial. I don't know what the legal situation is in other countries in Europe, but obviously the German taxpayers have spent a lot of money trying to assuage their guilt, and to be told that that was for something that didn't happen is just unacceptable in Germany. So although probably the largest group of Holocaust deniers is in Germany, it's also the place where it's criminalized. On the other hand, you know, there's an increasing number of Holocaust tours, Holocaust museums, museums of Jewish history in general cropping up all over Europe, sometimes in unexpected places where Jewish history may have come to an end in 1492, for example. But these days, you see societies trying to come to grips with the Jewish aspects of their past and their past treatment of Jews, including what they did or didn't do during the Holocaust. So, for example, at a Jewish museum in Berlin or in Prague or in Paris, increasingly you see groups of school children from other countries in Europe or even from as far away as Argentina learning about various aspects of Jewish history, sometimes specifically about the Holocaust, and sometimes about the rest of Jewish history. And, you know, the Jewish presence in Europe goes back more than 2,000 years. And it wasn't only about being killed and being victims. It was about helping to build and create Western culture.
Western civilization, for that matter.
Right. Law, the economy, society,
arts,
everything, medicine, whatever. So the other question that you raised at the very beginning is the use of the Holocaust in art. And I think, you know, obviously there are plays about the Holocaust, there are paintings about the Holocaust. What uses are legitimate and illegitimate is maybe something we could discuss next time.
Sounds like a great plan. Fascinating, powerful, and for many people, painful subject. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. One day, 6-year-old Melissa says to her mother, "Mommy, I've been thinking about human beings and I'm puzzled. How did we people first appear on Earth?" "It's a very good question, darling," her mother replies. "You see, God made Adam and Eve, and they had children, and then their children had children, and as a result, humanity began." Later that day, young Melissa asks her father the same question. "Daddy, how did human beings first appear on Earth?" "That's an intelligent question, Melissa," he replies. "You see, millions of years ago, there were monkeys, from which gradually the human race evolved." Melissa's confused and goes back to her mother. "Mommy," she asks, "how come you told me human beings were created by God, but Daddy says they came from monkeys?" "Oh, darling," replies her mother, "the answer's simple. I told you about my side of the family, and your father told you about his." That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew. A special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. Journeys are centrally important in Judaism. The act of leaving and heading out into the great unknown is crucial for us. At some level, the theme song for Jews might be "On the Road Again." Repeatedly in Jewish tradition, great leaders, even the whole of our people, head out into the wilderness to seek God and make a new life somewhere else. It happened first with Abraham in the portion of Lech Lecha. It happens 2 generations later with Jacob, whose name is changed to Israel and is in most ways the founder of our people. And it happens again with Moses, who flees his country of birth in Egypt to find God in the Sinai and then leaves there to go back to Egypt. And finally, takes the whole people of Israel out of slavery in this week's portion of Beshalach, and brings them to the path of redemption and freedom. It keeps happening throughout Jewish history, of course. The notion of the wandering Jew has ideological relevance as well as pathos. Wandering seems to be something we need to do, not just something we're forced into. In particular, Jewish religious tradition has a peculiar perspective on the events of the Exodus, which climax in this week's portion of Beshalach. It's true that the drama really begins with the story of the Exodus and the escape from Pharaoh on the shore of the Sea of Reeds, so it's logical we focus on that. But in our prayers, practices, and traditions, we raise up this escape from slavery and just going out into the wilderness to some spectacularly high historical status, far beyond what might seem to be appropriate. It's not just the way we make Passover such a central holiday. A festival of freedom, of course, should be focally important, also notable on this Martin Luther King weekend. But in Jewish tradition, we continually remind ourselves of the Exodus. Every Friday night when we say Kiddush, we declare that we observe the Sabbath, Zecher Letziat Mitzrayim, in remembrance of the Exodus from Egypt. Which isn't really true, since according to our own Torah, the Shabbat goes back to God's creation of the world, long before the Exodus. We focus on this great narrative and its denouement in nearly obsessive ways as Jews. Why? Perhaps because, in effect, our central Jewish story is about transition, about travel, about getting on the road again. It's the core narrative of Judaism. To paraphrase Descartes, we left. Therefore, we are. Our essential nature as a people is formed by this exodus. When we find ourselves in slavery, either physical, psychological, or moral, we must, as Jews, choose to leave. and seeing how our ancestors did it, against all odds, in order to find a new life of freedom and covenant with God, can still inspire us today. When we come back on Two Jewish, our guest, the great scholar of Kabbalah and Hasidism, Rabbi Dr. Art Green, will explore and explain how we can access this great storehouse of Jewish mysticism today, all of us. Find out when we return on Two Jewish.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million-dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114.
There's nothing like a live radio show to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the Two Jewish Radio Show, featuring Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends. It's live at the Fox Theater on March 2nd.
Better than Prairie Home Companion, it's Deli Home Companion. Join me and my great guests, including Richard Lewis, for a live radio variety show to benefit Jewish Family and Children's Services, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and Temple Emmanuel, Saturday night, March 2nd at the Fox.
Tickets at the box office and foxtucsontheater.org, or learn about sponsorship opportunities by calling 327-4501.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Jewish leaders representing the Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, and Reconstructionist movements are all answering the nation's call for ways to end gun violence. Together, they have held news conferences, written to Vice President Joe Biden's Gun Control Task Force, and sent official letters to Congress. Back on January 15th, which would have been Martin Luther King Jr.'s 84th birthday, members of an interfaith alliance known as Faiths United to Prevent Gun Violence held a news conference urging Americans to work together to help curb gun violence. They called for a ban on assault weapons and high-capacity ammunition magazines, as well as improved background screening for gun buyers. They also spoke of a need to improve the way we deal with mental illnesses. These ideas were included in a two-page letter to the United States Congress, which urged members to lead the way towards a safer society that not only protects children in schools against a mass shooter, but also stops individual inner-city gun murders as well. The letter was signed by 47 religious leaders from numerous faiths, including the Jewish Council for Public Affairs, the Reconstructionist Movement, the Rabbinical Assembly, the Religious Action Center of Reform Judaism, the United Synagogue of Conservative Judaism, and Women of Reform Judaism. Rachel Laser, Deputy Director of the Religious Action Center, said at the news conference that there has been enough pain, enough despair, enough injustice. Let us learn from our grief and the errors of the past and resolve in this very moment to do better. Religious leaders throughout the country will mobilize their congregations to join in an interfaith call to prevent gun violence on February 4th. On that day, Americans are directed to call their Congress member and ask that they be held accountable for the safety of our communities. January 14th, a letter was sent to both the president and vice president as well. It, too, made an urgent plea to address the subject of gun violence. That letter was spearheaded by the Rabbinical Assembly's Rabbi Julie Schoenfeld and organized by Susan Stern of the Council of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships and Rabbi David Saperstein, the Religious Action Center of Reform Judaism, past guest of Two Jewish a couple of times. As religious and nonprofit leaders, the letter said, we commit to building consensus and support in our communities for steps that will turn our collective grief into shared hope. We acknowledge that the privilege of American freedom carries a moral responsibility. Another letter sent to Biden's task force came from Agudat Israel of America, NORICA, the National Orthodox Organization in New York. Violent incidents that have occurred in school settings during the past number of years have demonstrated that the need for security hardware, cameras, metal detectors, barricades, etc., is particularly compelling. Unfortunately, despite the need for increased school safety, whether in the realm of disaster preparedness or crisis management, budgets put forward by the Bush and Obama administrations and passed by various Congresses have significantly and steadily slashed funding for these purposes, to the point where meaningful federal school safety assistance is virtually non-existent, Aguda Israel's Rabbi Abba Cohen wrote. In other news, Leon Lason, who was the youngest of 1,100 Jews saved from the Nazis by Oskar Schindler, died in California last week at the age of 83. Lason was 10 or so when Germany invaded Poland in 1939. He lost two brothers during the Holocaust, but was protected by Schindler, and at 13 years old worked in his factory. Dubbed Little Lason, he was so short he stood on a box to operate the machinery. He later moved to the U.S. and taught for 39 years. Lason rarely spoke of his experiences until the 1993 movie Schindler's List sparked renewed interest. He then embarked on a public speaking career to share his remarkable story. And that's the news of Jews around the world.
We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi Dr. Arthur Green, one of the world's preeminent authorities on Jewish mysticism, Jewish thought, spirituality, and Hasidism. He is the rector of the rabbinical school at Hebrew College in Boston, also the Irving Brudnick Professor of Philosophy and Religion at Hebrew College, and Professor Emeritus at Brandeis University, also taught at the University of Pennsylvania, and was the dean and president of the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College from 1984 to 1993. Dr. Green has published Radical Judaism, Rethinking God and Tradition through Yale University, Eheyeh, a Kabbalah for Tomorrow, A Guide to the Zohar from Stanford University Press, Seek My Face, Speak My Name, a number of other books, and a seminal work on Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav. He lectures throughout the world, and it's a pleasure to have him back. I will tell you, Art, I read an article that David Ellenson gave me a long time ago when I was in rabbinical school, in which you describe how the Hasidic movement was in some ways the most radical movement in Judaism and came to an edge and then turned back. Can you explain that process?
That's right. Yes, I'm glad you saw that article. Not many people know it, but it would be David Ellenson who gave it to you. Hasidism, in a way like the Sufi movement, you might say, within Islam, there's an interesting parallel there, was so profound in its understanding of the relationship between God and the soul that in some ways all the trappings of religion came to be seen as only a backup system, as somewhat secondary. The real point was the soul's adventure in seeking its source in God. And the tradition was used to bring you to that point and then to help reintegrate that experience into your life. But the essence was really that inner soul journey. And that could almost mean that one doesn't need the outer trappings of religion, that one could do it without the forms. But then Hasidism stepped back and said no. It became a way of defending the tradition. And that's partly because of its history. It appeared on the scene in the 18th century, just before the ghetto walls broke down and modernization entered East European Jewish life. Once East European Jews were struggling with modernity, Hasidism made a right turn, you might say, and became a kind of ultra-Orthodox defender of the tradition, which it hadn't been at the beginning at all. The great rabbis in the 18th century were persecuting and excommunicating the Hasidim. By the early 19th century, they were embracing them as the true champions of Orthodoxy. It's a very interesting historical moment.
And that's sort of why we see Hasidim as ultra-Orthodox, as Haredim, as people who reject modernity and reject sort of forward movement. But the movement certainly didn't start that way.
Absolutely not. If you had told the Baal Shem Tov, the first figure of the movement, or his disciples, that they were ultra-Orthodox Jews, they would have had a good laugh. because they were in fact being persecuted and being declared heretics.
Are heretics critical to the development of Judaism?
Well, let's say that controversy is. Jews like to argue. We've liked to argue for a long time. In some ways, our Talmudic culture is built around argumentation. And the idea that we have varying points of view and that this is true and that's true and something else is true as well, that's the very essence of the Jewish mindset. You know, Judaism was never able to be fundamentalist, really, because we always said this is true and here's another level of reading and that's true and this third one or fourth one are true as well. And that doesn't make for fundamentalism. It does make for inner conflict and inner conversation. But I think that's what stimulates growth and challenge.
I know I mentioned earlier in the show that you could really, as a very well-educated Jew in America, never know anything about Kabbalah or mysticism and consider it really non-normative, really not part of Reform, Conservative, even Orthodox Judaism. And you said what's important in reintegrating Jewish mysticism, which was excluded because of our choice of, you know, trying to be mainstream, was how it's done. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yes, it's very important. The mystical tradition contains all kinds of elements. It grew over a period of almost 1,000 years, you might say, and it was very closely aligned with what you would call folk religion and popular beliefs. If you don't like them, you call them superstitions. And some people, in turning to the mystical tradition, are trying to exploit those aspects of the tradition. So the idea that if you study in our system, we can promise you happiness, good luck, good fortune, wealth, all that stuff, as far as I'm concerned, is nonsense. But the mystical tradition is, in fact, a home of great and profound ideas and really a path toward inner self-transformation, which is hard spiritual work. You know, the work has to be done. The mystical tradition, I like to say, is a toolbox. It's a wonderful toolbox, but you have to use it. You have to do the work on yourself, and that's what it's really all about. And a lot of the outer phenomena superficial experience is really something we could leave behind. The mystical tradition was developed, after all, in the Middle Ages, and it contains aspects that really belong to medieval culture that just don't work in the 21st century. So it's a question of pulling forth the most profound ideas and seeing how we can translate them into language that works for us.
Hasidim kept Kabbalah, at least for the Ashkenazic world, alive and active, but they simplified Kabbalah in some idiosyncratic ways. Can you explain that process?
Yes, that's what Hasidism is. It is Kabbalah turned into a mass movement. Martin Buber, the great neo-Hasidic scholar, called it mysticism become ethos, really become a way of life. It took the central aims of Kabbalah, which is to say the ascent of the soul, the union of the soul in God, discovering the presence of God everywhere, and that the divine within the soul, the divine within the world, and the mysterious beyond are all one. Those are the essential truths of Kabbalah, but it stripped it of the very complicated Kabbalistic symbolism that had developed by the time Hasidism came around. Kabbalah had become highly abstruse. You had to memorize ten elements in four worlds, but each of them contained all the others, and therefore there were 400 systems to keep straight and so on. It was very, very difficult to really enter into all the Kabbalistic meditations on the names of God and so forth. And the Hasidim stripped it down to a very simple truth: being and nothingness, emptiness and fullness. Everything contains the presence of God, and outer reality is only a veil that you have to lift in order to discover the divine presence within all things. The Baal Shem Tov, the founder of Hasidism, or the first central figure of Hasidism, was a person of just deep religious experience of the natural world, of the presence of God right here in concrete reality. And that's what he tried to convey to people, how to make everyday reality a way of serving God and a way of discovering the sparks of divine light that fill the universe. And that's really the message.
Now, there are many different approaches today to applying Kabbalah, which, you know, was actually a word most of us didn't know. Suddenly, it's become extremely popular in the last 20 or 30 years. The Hasidic approach is one, but not the most sort of not the most publicly obvious. Can you talk a little bit about some of the ways, besides the scholarly, that Kabbalah has become popular?
The Jewish people has voted with its feet in the last 20 or 30 years to re-access the mystical tradition. The question is how to do it. Now, you have the very highest level of that, I would say, in our dear friend Daniel Matt's translation of the Zohar, being published by Stanford University Press. That's a high level academic enterprise, but it's also meant for people who want to approach the text in a scientific as well as spiritual way.
We, in the interest of full disclosure, I should note that we started, we were the first group, actually, in my congregation to start studying the Zohar with Danny's translation the week after it came out. And we've been doing it ever since. So I have no idea if we are succeeding or not, but we're still doing it.
Well, I'm very happy to hear that. And then there, you can say there's another end of the spectrum, and that is some of the popular groups that call themselves Kabbalists and market holy water and market books and so on. And I think that really, in some ways, defames the quality of what Kabbalah really has to teach. Now, there are people who go to these popular places and do get something out of it. I don't mean to say that they haven't done some good. I think they have. But they have commercialized the enterprise far beyond what I think is acceptable. And there are a lot of phenomena between those two. I took two ends of a spectrum, but the spectrum is alive in all kinds of ways. You walk into a Jewish bookstore today, and you can see hundreds of books on Kabbalah. Not all of them good. You have to pick carefully, but there's a great deal out there. And that was not the case a couple of decades ago.
A Hasidic question. While most people know about Hasidim today because of Lubavitch and the Chabad movement, which is ubiquitous really all around the Jewish world, literally, there's a great deal more to Hasidic mysticism. You've written on Nachman of Bratslav, I think of the Kutzker Rebbe, really broad spectrum. Can you just sort of touch on the different elements of the Hasidic approach to mysticism?
Hasidism began in the late 18th century, first as a few small circles of people who had rebelled against what Kabbalah had become. Kabbalah, as I say, had become overly abstruse. It also had become very committed to asceticism and to a very sparse and otherworldly way of life. Hasidism wanted to rediscover the presence of God in the concrete, in the ordinary, in the joy of living rather than in rejecting life. So it began with a small circle of people, and then in the course of about 50 years, it was a tremendously successful religious movement. It really conquered almost all of East European Jewry, except for Lithuania. Jews all over Poland, the Ukraine, Galicia, on into Hungary. Hasidism became the dominant force in Jewish life. As that happened, of course, there were different varieties within the movement. Chabad was one. That was the style of Hasidism that existed in the northern area, White Russia, near the Lithuanian border. And that was a highly intellectualized Jewish community. And Chabad was a sort of intellectual contemplative mysticism. But there were other sorts. The Hasidism of the Ukraine was very different, much more popular, down to earth. Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav, about whom I wrote, created a Hasidic method all his own, really a Hasidism for intense seekers, for people who felt the absence of God in their lives. Maybe you would say today people struggling with depression and who needed to cry out and long for the divine presence. And that too became a very powerful kind of Hasidic tool. So there were, I would say you can point to half a dozen major schools within Hasidism that developed over the years. Partly, these schools developed partly because there was a sense from the beginning that the old fires were cooling off, that Hasidism had been most intense and spiritually alive in its first days. But once the movement spread forth and became popular, it inevitably had compromised and the passion had cooled down. And then the question was how to rekindle the passion. Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav had a saying. He said, Jews are like knishes. The ingredients are all the same, but I prefer the hot ones to the cold ones. if you know what a cold knish is, you understand why you need to eat.
Very well.
And relighting the fire was important, and then each group had its own sense of how to go about that.
I want to thank Rabbi Dr. Art Green for a terrific visit here on Two Jewish Free. Like, we've only begun to scratch the surface. Looking forward to seeing you here in Tucson. Thank you for a terrific visit.
Thank you. I look forward to being there.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be A.O. Oppenheimer, the creator of a brand new and pretty wild website called Sensually Jewrotica. Our playout this morning comes in honor of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. weekend. It's the late Rabbi Shlomo Carlbach singing Leman Achai V'Re'oi, because of my brothers and friends, because of my sisters and friends, please let me ask, please let me say peace to you. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Because of my brothers and friends, because of my sisters and friends, please let me ask, please let me sing peace to you. This is the house, of the Lord. I wish the best for you. This is the house of the Lord.